The views and content expressed on the following program are provided solely for informational and entertainment purposes. They do not constitute legal advice. A podcast is not a substitute for retaining a competent, licensed attorney to advise you on your specific legal situation.
How's it going, everybody? I am Elisa Rockdock, subbing in, being your substitute teacher, rolling in that old CRT television with the VCR attachment and putting in Fern Gully and basically babysitting you for the next hour and making sure that I don't have to send anybody to the principal's office because that's right, your teacher, Ryan, is not here today. Hello, everybody, and welcome to Break the Business, where we empower indie creators and have some fun along the way. And I would love to just go ahead and just call her in, because this is nothing if not a period and time for collaboration. I would like to call in our producer, Lauren, if she is available, so that she can hold my hand, .mp3, Hootie and the Blowfish reference. And carry me through this lazy river of a show. Hi, Lauren. How are you doing?
Oh, I am loving. See, you can't see me backstage, but I'm losing it. I'm like, oh my God, I love Fern Gully. Like, where did that come from?
It's always Fern Gully.
I feel like we bring Elisa on just for the references. Like, I spend the whole time going like, oh, I didn't. Oh, that's a good one.
Yes. Yes, I'm nothing if not good for the quick pulls. Thank you for joining me tonight. Thank you, anybody who is currently in our live audience, wherever you are, watching us, listening to us, volume, all manner of platforms. Maybe you are listening to us in the future. Right? That's maybe crazy. maybe it's next week by the time you're listening to us. Wherever it is that you are right now, snuggled and cozy, thank you for spending your time with us this hour and not, you know, the Panthers game that's currently going on or any other manner of playoff basketball that's happening, or the first round of the NFL draft. So we happen to have a all of those things are happening right now. The Florida Panthers are currently playing hockey. It is the first round of the NFL draft.
Are we winning?
Some manner of playoff basketball. Well, hold on a second. Let me ask my assistant here.
Oh.
What's the Panthers score?
See, our audience on XM145, shout out to Slam Radio.
Right.
They usually have, you know, coverage of these sports games. So they're going to be like, yeah, Break the Business is, you know, keeping our track record straight here. So we got to give a shout out to our home team of the Florida Panthers. How are they doing?
So far at the end of the second period, as we are recording this and speaking, it is the end of the second period and the Panthers lead 3-2 against the Tampa Bay Lightning.
Two Florida teams.
See,
yeah, right, right, right.
I know, yeah, it's Evan and I have joked that this is the battle of the Cuban sandwiches, because I hear that Tampa has a very particular way. I think they add salami to the Cuban sandwich, and Miami does not. Mm-hmm. And there's kind of like a battle,
like a Cuban meat. Like at
it's
all.
Kind of like a battle as to like which one is sort of like the more, you know, like the more authentic version. And Tampa like comes in strong. And so far they have Cuban sandwich like festivals and competitions up there. And so far, apparently some of the winners, they got salami in them. So at some point I you know what? I propose next time I'm in Florida, I say Break the Business field trip. And let's do a definitive taste test of Cuban sandwiches and determine, like, is the salami?
I'm not saying it wouldn't taste good. It might be an improvement on the Cuban sandwich. But like, if you went to Philly and were like, "Hey, we put salami on your cheesesteak," like, it might be delicious. But like, is it your authentic cheesesteak?
Is this like a ship of Theseus situation? how many ingredients do we swap out before it is no longer identifiable as the thing?
Yeah. Now it's just a new delicious sandwich. Why don't they want to call it like the Tampa sandwich?
Like you can have your own thing. It could be the Ybor sandwich.
I just created this amazing sandwich and I'm so far from the, but I'm going to credit this other country for the sandwich. I'm like, I'm going to make a Cuban sandwich.
Have you ever been to Cuba? No. There's a long storied history and I'm sure we're going to get yelled at in the comments. And that is what we like to call engagement farming, folks.
That's right. Fight me.
Thank
fight
you for
me.
Taking the bait.
I thought you were going to go with like, you're fighting over the sandwiches. And I thought we were going to talk about these warm weather places having ice hockey champions.
Yeah. There is that. I also currently live in Dallas. That is warm. It does experience snow sometimes, but, there is a hockey team. I would not call them successful at the moment. They are in the playoffs. They are down 2 games in the first series. However,
warm weather teams. Headquarters.
And well, yeah, we are usually a football city and also sometimes a basketball city, I think, depending on whether or not the Mavs are doing okay. But
I could be corrected, but I think we looked it up at one point and there were no Floridians on any of the Florida hockey teams. Like we might have teams in Florida, but they're not from Florida.
Like I want my goalie to be from like West Kendall.
I want to not be able to pronounce his last name. If I can pronounce your last name, I don't want you on my Florida team.
Like I need to know that my goalie and my center and my enforcer have like a go-to Flannies order. Like I need to know this about my players.
See,
I need
to
know.
Those people don't know how to play on the ice. They don't want to get cold.
I have tried. Evan is Evan, my guitar player and paramour. Played indoor hockey for some of his youth. And because of that, I've gotten into hockey very, very recently. And it's actually a really cool sport in that it's really fast paced. I would consider it, you know, come at
yeah, for sure.
But like a little more fast paced than say like soccer, football. There's not a lot of ad breaks in it. The action is pretty constant. 3 periods in and out. Overtime is sudden death, just straight up. and if the period ends and then it goes to a shootout and you play until there's a winner. No ties. When they go through their 2 intermission breaks, they actually give you a little countdown timer on a ticker that tells you how much time is left before you can come back to the television. And I don't know. It's just these like little quality of life improvements that I'm finding with hockey. Specifically that I hadn't considered before.
And it happens so fast.
It does.
Like the transition, like if you're like, this seems like a slow part of the game. Mm-hmm. You can like walk away in football. It's like you blink your eyes and you're like, what do you mean they just scored? When did that happen? Yeah. So you have to watch. You're like, you have anxiety.
Yes.
They make a break for it. And you're like,
I have to lean in. Things bounce off of places. Bounce off of people.
And then they become hormonal teenagers and just start beating on each other for no reason.
And that's like that they can do. And it's part of like, it's part of the thing that they do in hockey is they just like, all right,
you have to get into their heads. You need to duke it out. You need them to be afraid. Like, and that's all fair game.
Just smiles with various numbers of teeth. Displayed
overrated.
I love it. I don't know. It's not just because Henrik Lundqvist, part of the TNT/TBS commentary team, has an excellent tailor. That has nothing to do with why I've recently gotten into hockey. Pero,
all right then.
Go Florida Panthers. Go Florida Panthers. And also, once again, keeping up a longstanding tradition of folks calling a team a South Beach/Miami team when it is firmly located in Sunrise, right by Sawgrass Mills.
Hey, at least for the Florida Panthers, it's like the only Miami team where you're like, they don't play in Miami anymore. But like they play in Miami and they're the Florida Panthers, so we'll take it.
And the Miami Dolphins is more of a North Miami Beach sort of thing. It's not it's Miami Gardens. It's Miami Gardens Dolphins.
We'll get,
And that, folks, is your hyper local, hyper specific local sports moment. If you were
currently playing, it counts.
If you are not in possession of a 305 or 786 area code, this was very niche and probably very confusing. But thank you.
Everyone in the world knows the Florida Panthers right now because we're on the radar. Though I think if we're targeting our indie creators, there are far less indie creators out there on the hockey world. I think we need more hockey wives making jerseys that wives can wear. Like, I was all about that happening in the football world. I was like, yes, create and use that market.
There's a couple of good, relatively interesting hockey creators, but it's more of like a sort of like a trick shot sort of thing. I would like to see a lot more, because I know recently I've seen a lot of like football teams really, really upping their social media game. And now I'm kind of like, all right, NHL,
get
in
there.
Let's rip it up.
Because most of them don't speak English all that well, so they're not doing social. They're doing their job. They're like playing their sport.
I need the hard knocks of hockey. I need that behind-the-scenes documentary. I want to know everything about the Zamboni.
You want to see the dental work after the fact?
I did. You joke, but there was one ESPN SportsCenter special featured segment that was about a team dentist for a hockey team and how hard that job is.
Oh, I'm sure. They took a cast of everyone's full mouth before they started the season, and they just like have backup teeth sitting back in the back.
It's like bringing it back around to music. It's like a musician getting your custom molded earplugs and just making a set of new ones whenever you gotta do your...
Except we're not busting our eardrums every gig, hopefully, if we're wearing those in-ears.
But speaking of content creators and indie creators and musicians and showing off the things that you enjoy in spaces that you occupy, I did want to bring up one small article before we get into the sort of pre-designated contractually obligated career update.
I'm so excited about that part. And don't forget that later on in the show, after the break, we're going to be talking with Jonathan Shank. I'm very excited about that. I was chatting with him a couple of days ago. We're going to hear about his new podcast and all of the many, many things he's doing in the live entertainment industry. But we can't get to that till after we get a career update. And we can't get to a career update until whatever this fascinating article you want to share with us is.
So when Ryan left me his substitute teacher plans,
I love this.
Thankfully, I love it. I love it when a teacher does this for me, and he's like, "Here is a folder full of articles. Have fun. Pick one and have fun." There was one that resonated with me in particular from Chris Robley of the Reverb Nation blog, that was about debunking the biggest myth about TikTok for musicians. Of course, this article comes at a wonderful time when we are currently questioning the future of TikTok as a platform, very specifically. So the bill has been signed. It appears that ByteDance has a few months to load off TikTok to a US-based company or face a ban entirely. And while that is kind of harrowing for a lot of indie creators that have sort of made a significant stride on TikTok, all is not lost necessarily if you were possibly on the fence about like, hey, maybe I was thinking about TikTok and now I'm like, well, now it's kind of going away. Should I even give it a try? My personal opinion, personally, I would argue that it's going to take a few months for any of this to come out in the wash. And that doesn't even necessarily account for
delays based on lawsuits and such. So if you have been considering TikTok as a platform, I would still recommend it as a creator. And maybe you might be the kind of person that sort of sees like a little bit of that runway and that kind of potential deadline. And this is sort of like a kind of an out of left field way of thinking about it, maybe. But all right, maybe I have 6 to 9 months to let loose and figure out the kinds of things that I can make on this platform that maybe I can extrapolate to other things like Instagram Reels or YouTube Shorts, and maybe use this place as a potential playground for ideas while it's still in this kind of unsettled space, this kind of funky possibility space. And so to that point, Chris Robley from Reverb Nation blog writes about debunking the biggest myth about TikTok for musicians if you are planning on heading over there to TikTok to try your luck, not just as a musician, but also as another indie creator. What do you think the biggest myth about TikTok is?
That it's a money-making platform.
I don't necessarily know if that is even something that has been espoused as truth all that much.
Like, people are like, you know, there are these people making millions on TikTok. I'm like, oh, where did you hear that?
Are they in the room with us right now? These TikTok millionaires?
Are they real?
Are they in the room with us right now? The myth is that TikTok prohibitively skews toward a particular age or demographic. I hear this all the time from people that are on Instagram or maybe even making their way to YouTube. And if I ask them about TikTok, especially folks like voice actors too, when they think about places like TikTok, they're like, oh, but that's for like kids, and that's for like dances, and that's all it is. Or like, it's only for, you know, a Taylor Swift or some other sort of pop artist to activate their communities. And it's maybe even only for like comedy music, buff people chopping wood. I don't know what's on your algorithm.
We just keep going into the like more and more, like they're all of those things.
Yeah. But I would argue, and so does Chris Robley, that this is actually the biggest myth of it all. In fact, one of the coolest things about TikTok, and you know, regardless of hullabaloo about ethics in terms of what is happening to data and blah, 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 as just sort of a platform, period, I have found it to be very inspiring as an artist. And in specifically in how unique the algorithm is and how tailored it is, so much so that I have found in my time on the app that you are able to, if you put in the work, if you kind of train your algorithm, you follow the right people, you know, you create content that is unique to you and you use sort of the kind of right tags, you will find your people and your people will eventually find you. And it's not just for kids, and it's not just for dance trends. In fact, so much of my algorithm is filled with artists showing time-lapse processes of their art. Visual artists, glass blowers, all sorts of musicians that are doing fun things with duets and stitching. I follow an artist by the name of Ska Tune Network, who's a ska musician that does wonderful ska covers of pop songs and video game songs. And sometimes they'll do funny duets with their trombone, sometimes on top of spoken words, sometimes collaborating with other musicians via duets and stitches. And I think there is a lot of potential content avenues that you might be shutting yourself off from if you think that like TikTok is just for kids. Silly rabbit.
Or TikTok. Just anything, really. Because those platforms are just there, like you said, to connect you to your community. And it's a wide enough net that whatever the majority is doing isn't as relevant as who you can reach. So if you can reach your 30 people, that might be a very small percentage of the people paying attention to this platform. But if you can reach those people that you that were your target audience, then it's a perfect place for you to be. So I wouldn't listen to a lot of those it's just anythings because it can be anything you want it to be. We've emphasized before, and I would emphasize again, whether you're using TikTok or any other social platform, protect your data, protect your creation. So if you make 100 videos in the next year and TikTok disappears, please tell me you backed all of those 100 videos up so that you can put them onto something else. You can do something else with them. And, you know, they always say no press is bad press. Mm-hmm. Like if there's talking about it, if there's a ban coming and they've never heard of it, this is new people coming to the platform. This is people who care about the platform, standing up for the platform. Whatever the reason is that they're going to it, new people are currently flocking.
Yep.
If it gets a new owner and it keeps going, great. If it crashes and burns, but you met 50 people on the way there and you got their email addresses and you sent them to your website and you kept your information, wherever you go next, you can take your audience with you. So I don't ever think it's a time to avoid anything. And even if it's about to crash and burn, like if everyone's got their phone out and they're taking video of the crashing and burning coming, like, why not get on camera?
Metaphorically. Legal disclaimers at the beginning of the show, et cetera, et cetera.
This is what happens when the lawyer goes out of town.
This is what I'm saying. This is what happens when you let me substitute teach for you. But all of that to say, use this opportunity, this sort of funkiness, and see it as an opportunity to dive in. And if there is something where you're like, well, I feel like I have to follow a certain formula and like pump out videos in a certain way and like put out videos where it's like my song playing on TikTok over some like cryptic text or whatever. But another weird thing that I like to do is I like to, I don't know, collect vintage teapots or whatever and like show off that collection actually. Lean into the weird thing, because oftentimes that weird thing can be the hook that leads people to your account, follows you. And also, I don't know, just sort of philosophically, like, wouldn't you want your fans to be people that think your teapot collection is cool too?
Yeah.
Like, that's kind of a cool community to be able to cultivate. Like, you get to build the folks that want to hang out. If there are people willing to stick with your teapot collection, then they're going to ride with you for everything else. So don't be afraid to get weird, because especially when there's going to be the sea and influx of people coming to the app, more than ever, it pays to lean into what makes you different and unique. And that's the authentic thing. That's the real thing. Don't chase what's going to be popular for everybody else. Now, do your thing and find your people.
Yeah. If you've already heard about it because it's popular, it's probably too late to be on that trend. So,
And sort of on the sort of reverse note of everything that we've saying, if for whatever reason you have put all of your eggs in the TikTok basket, another recommendation is to make sure that you have squatted on your username on every possible potential platform that already exists and maybe even a potential successor, just in case.
Remember, I keep thinking about the poor guy on X who had the X account and they were just like, so ours now. And he was like, you know, like he's like, what can I do? They own the platform. Technically, they can do that. And so again, I keep going back to and will keep going back to protect your stuff. Your website, your homepage is your home. Make it a welcoming place that people want to come. Invite people into your home. You can meet them out in the real world as much as you want, but like, make sure your home is a welcoming place.
Absolutely. And keep all of your, and especially as people are moving platforms and shifting around and you are planning on working with, whether it's a booking agent, potential record label, somebody who you might be interested in doing a brand deal with, make sure that your contact information is visible wherever it is that
updated,
you end up.
Current, they
updated,
can
current.
Because if they can't reach you easily, they'll move on to the next person who they can reach. For sure.
Make it easy. Generally, the advice is make it as easy as possible for the universe to say yes to you.
I've been loving reading all the things happening on our chat board right now, but we're talking about TikTok being, you know, it's only for the young, only for the this. And I just read, you know, Twitch. Well, that's just for gaming stuff, right? And I laugh because I'm like, you know, it's the same kind of a theory. Like, you think it's for this, but like, we're doing a music and today's podcast.
Some of my favorite people to watch on Twitch are literal visual artists, people that are doing cool multimedia setups, cooking streams, people that run wildlife sanctuaries, showing off what it is that they do every day. There's room for everyone. You gotta find your people, but you know, put yourself out there and don't be scared. Your folks will be out there.
Absolutely. Okay, so before we go to break, I do want a career update.
Yes!
Alisa Rock Doc update. She doesn't have a song yet, but we're going to make one. It's Alisa Rock Doc update. I'm terrible.
Yep. And that was your
That's what happens update. When humans create our interests.
So I am... Basically, the theme of this week's career update is substituting, and that is the
not just here.
This is only one of the sort of substitute gigs that I am venturing into this week. I sort of talked about the wheeling in of the television, but I think I mentioned this last time I was on. I am a substitute teacher as sort of part of the. Goal to get out of debt and you know, kind of have consistent income, well, as consistent as substitute teaching can be, while VO and on-camera acting does its thing, because you never know with a VO gig or an on-camera gig or a photo shoot whether that's a net 45 payout or a net 90 payout or a net 180 payout.
Someday you'll get that check.
Someday, maybe in 6 months, hopefully, if they remember. And so in order to provide a little bit more consistency, I've been substitute teaching. I've only done half days so far, and literally tomorrow after this show, I am going to try to fall asleep as quickly as possible because tomorrow is my first full day of being a substitute teacher.
Do they still like put special things we used to do to substitute teachers?
So far, it's been chill. Nothing more than maybe like, you know, playing a silly soundboard sound from their Chromebooks or something while my back is turned.
You're getting like farting noises when you turn your back. Yeah, and then a class of giggling children.
But next, I decided to sort of ease myself into it by making it a music class that I'm substitute teaching for my first full day. So we're just gonna listen to and it's primary school. It's little, so you know, maybe
so Baby Einstein.
Yeah, a Slayer, a lot of Slayer. A significant amount of Misfits and Napalm Death and just gotta get them while they're young. You know, this is a foundational education that we're providing for these kids. So I'm hoping that it's a cool experience. And if you don't hear from me next month, then you probably know why.
And Miss Nelson is missing. Yes.
Do
you know who else was quite famously a substitute teacher before making it big? Lin-Manuel Miranda.
Hey,
there's lots of fun pictures of him substitute teaching because, you know, it's a flexible job. You're interacting with other people. You can take on a day when you can take on a day. And if you have to go to a gig, you go to your gig.
Exactly. Yeah,
I like it. I like it. I can't wait to hear your report on banging on drum desks and playing recorders. I highly recommend bringing some Advil with you.
I'm very much looking forward to. I don't know. Maybe we could do a thing where we like, I'm going to play some Zelda lo-fi and you can sort of draw pictures in response to the music and how it makes you feel. Who knows?
Oh, if I love those things.
Make my goal is to make it to 4 p.m. Central tomorrow, and we'll see what happens. Because on Saturday, my other substitute teaching gig is not substitute teaching, is substitute singing for a party band. And it's going to be my first gig being a substitute singer in a party band, and it's for a private corporate gig. No pressure at all. So,
oh, that's fun. How many people are in that band?
Let's see, 1, 2, 3, maybe a couple of singers. So maybe like between 5 and 6.
Okay.
Relatively like decent sized. And I won't be the only one singing, thankfully, for, you know, however 2 or 3 many hours. It's going to be a fun time, but it's like no rehearsals ahead of time. I haven't even gotten
You're not rehearsing at all?
Nope. Oh. I haven't even gotten a tune list.
Did you get a set list? No, nothing. Wow.
I got a dress code and an address.
Is it black? Wear your black.
Yep, formal. Yeah. Yep. Just black dress, show up with your in-ear monitors, and, you know, I'll have my iPad with my lyrics in case I need them. But other than that, I'm going to let go and let band leader and see what happens.
Ooh, I love it. Oh, my goodness. All right. Well, we wish you luck. I hope that we get to hear the follow up on that. And I think we'll look forward to hearing from Jonathan Schenck when we get back from our short commercial break.
Don't go anywhere.
Break the Business is presented in cooperation with Ryan A. Corella, PA. Ryan A. Corella, PA is a law firm providing transactional entertainment legal services, including contracts, business formation, commercial law, copyright, trademark, and more. Ryan A. Corella, PA, Miami, Florida. rkpalaw.com.
Streaming services for Break the Business provided by LEK Entertainment. LEK Entertainment is a full-service entertainment company offering everything from consultations to full-scale events and productions, including audio and video productions, voiceovers, staged theatrical productions, script and music development, and streaming services. For more information, visit lekentertainment.com. LEK Entertainment wants to help you bring your story to life.
Thanks for supporting Break the Business. If you have a question or topic that you want us to discuss, email us at breakthebusiness@gmail.com. You can follow the host, that's me, on Twitter at Ryan KAIR, and you can follow the show at the BTB Podcast. Be sure to subscribe to the show on Twitch, YouTube, and Facebook, and on all major podcast platforms. And now, let's get back to the show.
Alrighty, our guest is a leading live events producer, a Grammy Award winner, noted Deadhead, and host of a brand new podcast, The Jam. Let us welcome on Jonathan Schenck.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Welcome to Break the Business. You have a lot of bona fides, and I know I've missed quite a few already.
Well,
Thank you.
That was a wonderful intro.
Thank you so much. Now, you are also the head of Terrapin Station Entertainment, and I kind of noticed the combination Terrapin Station. It did just prominently feature Deadhead on your one sheet. I gotta ask, how deep does that deadheadedness go? We've named entire businesses. Tell me about just your love for the Dead straight up right now.
Get it straight up. It runs deep for sure, and I have always been inspired by the band for going back 35 years or so, and had the chance to see them and tour with them when I was in college, and was deeply inspired, not just by the way that they approach music, but also the way that they approach their marketing paradigm and the way that they redefined the business in so many ways, and were able to maneuver around a lot of the mainstream mechanics of the way that artists and bands are broken, and carve their own path through improvisation and collaboration and live performance. And as evidenced by the, not that many studio records that they put out compared to the thousands of shows that they put on, and now a 59-year legacy. Beyond my kind of passion for the band, I had the, honor to work with several members of the band, going back 20 years now, most prominently Mickey Hart, and have worked with Mickey on and off for a couple decades now, and worked on many different projects of all shapes and sizes. And he was one of the first people to really not just inspire me to be a producer, but also to really mentor me about putting on different kinds of events and being open-minded. And something that you said earlier is that that I'm totally aligned with, is that there's room for everyone. And I think just, you know, getting to that point psychologically, he really, you know, he comes in at eye level, and that's, I think, where everything starts. Like, you guys, you come in at eye level with everyone, you know, sparks can fly and things can happen.
Cool. Now, when it comes to your history as an event producer, I see here that you were the first intern at New Orleans's House of Blues location. And
yeah,
there's something about being in live event production for that long. I know there's definitely, I have experience doing some live event production. My spouse also has experience, and sort of seeing things from that side, you see some stuff. You've seen some things.
Oh my God.
Sure. In
But also, my main job, don't laugh, was hanging flyers in the bathrooms at the House of Blues.
Sorry, you said don't laugh.
And I mean, you have to start somewhere, right? But I mean, I think that when I showed up there, everything was kind of just getting moved into their offices, and so there was some organization of like artist bios and riders and things that kind of are fundamental to the music business that I had no idea about, marketing materials, et cetera. And at that time in the 90s, everything was physical. There was no digital. There wasn't such a thing as digital assets or digital materials. So that was a nice learning curve. But ultimately, I was like a utility person. Okay, we need these posters hung up on the telephone poles, you know, up near Tipitina's or whatever. And I was getting in my car and going to the record stores and dropping off flyers and just figuring out what, as you said earlier, just figuring out my entry point was, where to put those skills. I knew I wanted to be in music, but I didn't know exactly how I was going to achieve that. I mean, working at the House of Blues was interesting also because it was my first kind of peek behind the curtain of how live music worked, other than attending as a fan.
And when it comes to sort of, you know, because there's all sorts of professions that you can choose when you're, you know, getting into music, what was the sort of spark that said, I don't know what I'm going to do, but I need to be here somehow? Was it an artist? Was it a concert experience? Like, what was that thing?
Yeah. I mean, I knew at a very young age I wanted to be around music and in the music business. I originally thought I wanted to be a music attorney. And then I thought I wanted to be an A&R person because that seemed like a pretty hot job at the moment. And who doesn't want to go out and sign artists? But what I really figured out was that neither of those would end up becoming anywhere close to my entry point. I ended up as an assistant at a boutique agency working with a lot of classic rock bands in the late 90s. And classic rock bands weren't that in fashion in the late 90s. So not like now where, you know, legacy and nostalgia rule the world. In the late 90s, it was still kind of scrappy and private events. I mean, you mentioned you're doing a private event. Private events weren't at the same level. Corporate events weren't at the same level that they are now. So it was a very scrappy type business working with a lot of what I consider to be iconic Rock and Roll Hall of Fame musicians that were, you know, in the middle of their careers, and it wasn't the late 60s or 70s anymore. And so now in 2024, all of those things have come back into fashion, and, you know, vintage t-shirts and merchandise, and, you know, everybody gets away with everything in terms of building their brand. In the 90s, that just didn't exist in that way. So, I mean, even the Grateful Dead, coming back to that, weren't, you know, after Jerry passed, there was a period of time where they certainly weren't as as injected into pop culture as they are now with John Mayer as their lead guitar player and singer. So, I mean, there was a period of time where the Grateful Dead, the members of the Grateful Dead were playing theaters and small venues. Now they're breaking records in stadiums left and right. And so I think that it is a very interesting cyclical thing, but I think the point being is that, you know, I had a very humble start, and what I did realize though was how valuable each of those relationships were at the very beginning. And so a lot of those people that I worked with in the 90s, I still maintain rapport with, even if I don't work with them or have, you know, maybe touch base with them every once in a while. And I think that is what I learned very quickly, was how important those relationships would ultimately become. And, you know, that's the kind of core of where success starts in this industry, I think.
Yes. And now, not just all of these live events that you're producing in the sort of very specific live music realm, but you're also producing all manner of stage shows like Peppa Pig Live and Disney Junior Live. Like, how does something like a Peppa Pig show differ from a kind of a traditional musical act in terms of production? Like, interesting.
My answer to this is that actually I pretty much treat all of those projects like artists. And so a lot of the skill sets that it's just a different core audience. Mm-hmm. Peppa Pig is no different than the Grateful Dead. It's just, you have parents and kids that are watching Peppa Pig. They have their own version of Deadheads, you know, that are getting up every morning and Papers watching. Yeah, but it's in pop culture in a different way. All of these things start with core audience. You know, it's what I learned about the Grateful Dead is that it all starts, and jam bands, et cetera, is it all starts with the core audience. And I don't care if you're Taylor Swift or, you know, Grateful Dead or Peppa Pig, it all kind of comes back to how strong is your audience? How strong is their voice? What's their community? And so from a marketing standpoint, I honestly, a lot of what I did was took a lot of what I learned from the Grateful Dead and just applied that into kids' music. It's the same thing. It's just you're touring strategically in volume with the same way that the Grateful Dead would tour strategically in volume. So it's like very, you know, obviously the audience is different. You're 2 to 5 year old kids and their parents, and you know, it's digital marketing. Some of those mechanisms of reaching people is different, but the principles and the foundations are ultimately the same. And really for me, I'm only interested in working with projects that have strong core audiences. It could be a kid's show. It could be a artist. It could be, that's to me, the common denominator that lifts all of these things up, whether it's Peppa Pig or Disney or the Bob Marley Experience or working with Mickey Hart. It's really just understanding their audience and understanding that they have a community around them and how to tap that community. I treat them all very honestly similar. I think the intellectual property projects really appreciate being treated like artists as opposed to just being treated like a piece of intellectual property.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and definitely having that extra little bit of care, especially with, I have heard stories of people going to things like the Billy Joel and Stevie Nicks concert that just came through. I'm based out of Dallas, so that came through Arlington, and I was just seeing nothing but all of the most wonderful Instagram stories, and just the FOMO was so real on that one. That must have been a heck of a bill to work with.
Yeah. I mean, look, that's a dream come true. Billy Joel is one of my all-time favorite artists, and working with his team was, you know, an amazing experience. That show was 2.5 years in the making. I think we started working on that show at the end of 2021. And then it was supposed to happen in 2023, and then it got rescheduled because of somebody had COVID or something. And then it happened in 2024. So it was kind of like, is this show ever going to happen? Mm-hmm. Like, it was a sold out show when we found out 5 days before that it wasn't happening in 2023. So we waited a whole year. So it was really well worth it. It was an amazing show. And we partner with about 16 sports teams, which are MLS, MLB, and NFL teams, and help them really like as their right hand to present shows in their stadiums. And the way that we approach this is that, which is not anything that's groundbreaking, is that these stadiums have so many open dates every year because they're only X amount of home games. For a football team, that's only like 8 home games per year. There's a lot of room for activity. And even if promoters are bringing 2 or 3 shows to those stadiums, well, you can do the math. That still leaves a lot of days to do programming. It's very hard to procure these shows. It's like, I like to equate it to kind of like fishing for like marlin or something like that. If you were going to do that, like you're like kind of out there trying to like, you know, thread a needle because there's so few artists that play this level of facilities. There are so many other facilities out there. It might not align with their tour schedule. It might not align with the sports schedule. So it really is a very strategic business. It's a very different business for us in terms of like we have several verticals, but we have this, you know, what I call the sports division where we're ultimately presenting shows. We're not promoting them and we're not producing them. We're locked arms with the teams and we're presenting these shows. On the, you know, the stuff we were just talking about with Disney, we're licensing that intellectual property from those studios and then creating those shows and touring them around the country. So it's not like we're not like in position of like promoting one show or something like that. We're actually doing the casting for Mickey, Minnie, Goofy. We're doing all, we're, you know, overseeing the team that's doing the script writing, the choreography, the video packaging, the confetti, all of the production elements. So in that role, we are a, you know, in addition to being executive producer, we're also doing the physical production and involved in the creative of those shows. So that's kind of like a completely different business as opposed to, hey, Dallas Cowboys, wouldn't it be great if Billy Joel came and played your stadium and let's help you guys make that happen. So I think that's like for your audience, probably a good distinction to make because like it doesn't all fall into like one bucket. Like there's several different. And as you said, there's room for everybody, which I'm going to keep coming back to that because I honestly preach that all the time when I talk to college kids. I've done a lot of that, you know, in my career. And it's all just about figuring out your entry point. I think when people sometimes listen to what I do, it sounds like it's a little bit all over the place. But it is actually a very, as you know, there's different tentacles, but it is a very focused business. I kind of call what we do in the same way that people would regard Live Nation as like kind of a very traditional producer, promoter. They do all of the large pop, rock, country concerts. We're very much like the non-traditional Live Nation. You know, where we're doing things that are maybe that are not on their radar or maybe in different verticals like this family entertainment and, you know, and then threading these needles with these sports teams. And we also do a lot of, we have a great partner called Black Ink that does incredible film to orchestra work. So when you at like your local theaters, you know, when you see these shows that are on the brochure that maybe are like Spidey into the Spider-Verse with an orchestra. Yeah. So like this team is creating all those shows and you know, producing that. So we have that division, you know, we have the sports division and then we have kind of the licensing stuff. So it does seem like a lot, but it all does fit together really well. And it's not like we're like switching gears all the time, like between things. It's kind of, it all focuses into that, like content development and, you know, show development and asset creation.
Nice. And it's there is so much that goes into this gig. And I know that there are some folks that are listening to us that, you know, might be younger, maybe the same age as some of the college folks that you talk to, or even folks that might be looking for just another foray to sort of like dip their toes into the music industry itself. And I'm wondering, having started in the early 90s in a venue like House of Blues to producing things in huge stadiums, throughout the course of your career, what would you say makes a good live event producer? Like what are the things that somebody would kind of need to have if they want to really get into this?
You know, that's a great question. I actually had dinner with a producer that I really respect like a few months ago, and he has this like unbelievable checklist that he like rattles off of like what it takes to be a great producer. And I'm not going to be able to recreate it in the same way that he presents it, but it boils down to this. You have to have a certain amount you have to be willing to take a certain amount of risk. Okay. You have to be early and have some ideas. So you have to be, but ultimately if it comes down to the core skill set of being actually lifting up that event, it's all about organization and communication. And if you are, it doesn't matter what the size of the event is, there are always, the checklist is, could be the same size, right? You're still super serving whoever the artist, the client, the project. It really is all about that level of empowerment. The best skill that a producer can have is to be patient and to empower those that they work with and to work well as a team. There's room for everybody. And, you know, the best way to get things lifted up is to put together a great team and then empower the team and not get in the way.
Excellent. All right. Take notes. That's what it takes. Be very, very organized. And definitely when it comes to production, there's a lot of like ego checking at the door, being in service of the product, I imagine. Which, you know,
you don't have to know everything. Yeah. You don't have to be an expert in everything. It's fine to defer and to lean into people that know thing that are, you know, you don't have to know what, you know, lighting washes or how to operate in your monitors or the difference between, you know, you have to understand how to navigate to get the answers to those questions. Mm-hmm. Nobody expects that you know everything. I've never met anybody that's like, oh, I have the answer to every single production question. It's like, no, there's people that are creatives, there's people that are lighting and sound, and the best people that do this are understand where their strengths are.
Excellent. So find your niche and go to work. I love it. Now from live event production to podcast production, I want to turn our attention to your new podcast that you've recently launched, The Jam, featuring all manner of music legends that you're interviewing, including Randy Jackson, Robbie Krieger, and many, many more. When it comes to working with folks from a production perspective, what is it like having conversations in this kind of podcast venue? Tell us a little bit more about The Jam.
This is an entirely new platform. It's a bit of a jam and exploration for me too. The way that this started was over the holidays, I was thinking about some of the people that I've crossed paths with, and just in a very grateful way, looking at some of their stories and you know, trying to figure out if there was an avenue to help lift up some of these underappreciated musical heroes, mm-hmm. some of these little lost nuggets that maybe other people couldn't get out of some of these folks because they maybe don't have the relationship. And also going back to that word grateful, just using it as a bit of a platform to thank the people that helped me along the way, but also that have inspired so many others. And I think the word The Jam, the name The Jam, part of that came from the idea that there are so many people that are connected to the jam scene, or the larger fringes of the jam scene, that have touched mainstream music, that have touched pop culture, that have gone on to do things in larger platforms outside of that niche world. And I think most people don't actually know that Randy Jackson was the bass player in Journey. They don't know that he played, you know, bass with Jerry Garcia and Bob Weir and John Fogerty in Golden Gate Park. They don't know that he had deep Louisiana roots and loves the Meters and the Neville Brothers. Mm-hmm. People think of American Idol, and they think of a much more pop culture. And even if they do know those things, that's the connective tissue between the jam scene and the mainstream. And almost all of our guests in some way talk about that, talk about, you know, whether it was taking photos at the original Woodstock, and then next thing you know, those photos are on the cover of Life magazine. Mm. Like, this is, you're talking about something that is incredibly hippie jam niche that all of a sudden was the biggest thing in our country. And I think there's just so many examples of this, whether you're just talking about pure collaboration between artists and, you know, being blown away by, you never knew this person played with that person. But, you know, a big part of it is finding these little, you know, these little nuggets and just trying to lift some people up and get some more of these stories out there and help people to understand that it's the way that things get injected into pop culture. You just, you never know. And, you know, I have this great guest coming on in the future, which is not a celebrity at all, but he's the guy from Fox Sports who programs all the music for like World Series and Super Bowl, et cetera. Well, I don't know if you ever watched like NFL on Fox or World Series, but like a lot of the times, not all the time, there's like Grateful Dead, Fish, Goose, Mo, you know, playing like literally like the biggest moments in pop culture TV, like playing for like a billion people. When the Chiefs scored touchdown, they're going to commercial playing the Grateful Dead, you know, and for deadheads, we're all texting each other going, did you hear that? It's great. And for the other, you know, 999 million people that don't know it, they just are blowing it off or whatever, but there's little Easter eggs in there for the core fan base. But clearly it's injected enough into the mainstream that it's accepted. And you know, when you think back to Haight-Ashbury, the counterculture, this was a form of music that was not readily accepted. And so to have watched the way that it's developed since Jerry Garcia has passed in 1995, there wasn't even the word jam band didn't exist prior to his passing, that's created hundreds of bands. And I look at the marquee on Lollapalooza and I see Billy Strings right at the top. Okay. Billy Strings, I believe, would have been Jerry Garcia's favorite new artist. Billy Strings is a bluegrass player. Okay. He's playing at Lollapalooza. He's not just playing. He's on the top of the bill at Lollapalooza. And so that to me is just a reaffirmation that not only is there space for this music, but it's just going to continue to thrive. And the podcast is really all about bringing those stories together, bringing those people together. Some of the industry tastemakers that I've crossed paths with, some of the, you know, legendary artists and also, you know, just some folks that are dialing in the culture.
And where can our audience find your podcast?
Seamless. Oh, wow. So I have some incredible partners at Osiris Media. And you can find it at osirismedia.com. And the jam is on all the DSPs, Spotify, Apple Music, et cetera. And we've got Henry Diltz on the most current episode, who's the OG Woodstock photographer, Monterey Pop, You know, he's photographed everybody from Jimi Hendrix to the Mars and Hotel Doors album. And, you know, we just had Bill Payne from Little Feet, George Porter Jr. from The Meters, Robbie Krieger talking about how he wrote Light My Fire. And you know, a lot of these people are folks that I've crossed paths with in the past. And so it's everything's free flowing. Like, I don't prepare because it's the jam. You have to, it's all
exactly. Improvisation. I love it.
So perfect. So it's all just very, there's no production meetings. There's nobody else that helps me with it. I just go in and we have a 45 minute or hour conversation and we see where the jam takes us.
Excellent. Now, before we let you go and sort of bring this all to a wonderful crescendo and then a conclusion, like any great, great jam song.
Yes.
We have one more question to ask that we ask because you, of course, are an indie creator yourself with this podcast. Do you have any advice for our indie creators listening on anything they can do to push their careers forward?
Absolutely. The first thing I would say is don't worry about any barrier to entry. Just keep going. And that is number one, because even I've been in the music industry for 25 years. I never had any desire to do a podcast, but it's and or a platform or audience to do it. And so I think for anybody that has an idea, that has the bandwidth to be able to pull it off, don't be afraid, just go for it. You know, don't hesitate. There's an audience for you and people out there that will be excited to consume what you're putting out there.
And to summarize, the time to hesitate is through.
Yes.
That is right. Our guest this week has been live events producer, Grammy Award winner, and of course, noted Deadhead, Jonathan Schenck, and now brilliant podcast host. Thank you so much for joining us, Jonathan.
Oh, it's such a pleasure. Thank you, guys. You're amazing. Really enjoyed it.
Thanks. Oh, for more information, you can visit terrapinent.com. We thank you so much, Jonathan. Thank you, Elisa Rock Doc. And thank you, viewers and listeners. We will see you next week.
See ya.